It's the Trupany Show with your host, James Trupany.
Hello and welcome to the Trupany Show. My name is James Trupany. This is my show, and today we return to the Beginner's Guide to Japanese Professional Wrestling. And now, I know I said last week we were going to try and fit in Destruction in Kobe today, but we just were too busy. All of us have real life, unfortunately, and that affected us today. So we aren't going to do Destruction in Kobe. We'll do that next week. And we'll try and sneak in the Ring of Honor show as well, if we can all get hold of it and have a look at it. But today we're back at the Beginner's Guide to Professional Wrestling in Japan. And with me is Miss Chelsea Spollen. And today we're going to discuss All Japan Women 1992 Grand Prix Final. Chelsea,
woo!
You've really enjoyed this card a lot.
Yes,
so,
I did.
So what were your thoughts when I said, let's watch this, and you saw the card?
Well, I mean, just looking at the wrestlers on the card without even looking at the specific matches, I was like, heck yeah, let's do this, for sure.
Well, we will talk about that shortly, but we had some sad news last Sunday. And this is the first chance, I think, any of us at the WrestleTalk Podcast Network have had to talk about it. So we should just mention this. The great Bobby Heenan passed away last Sunday, and I've really been thinking about Bobby a lot. Obviously, there's been some great tributes this week from the WWE. Jim Ross, on his podcast, had an entire podcast devoted to the life and times of the Brain. I've written pieces for Total Wrestling this week, which will be on is their cover story for this month, about Bobby the Brain Heenan. And, you know, for a lot of people, especially my age group, Bobby got us through our youth of wrestling. He was the guy that really introduced us to a lot of people, either in the Heenan family when he was an active manager or as a commentator for both WWE and for WCW. He was the best manager there's ever been. We can't really say anything less than that. You know, his body of work in the wrestling industry back in the days when he was a proper true heel, you know, he was one of those guys who was actually deathly afraid of leaving the arena. And then he came into this family entertainment kind of period of his career in the 1980s, which he did an incredible job with, of great aplomb. Actually, one of my favorite promos was from a Saturday night's main event where he was managing Rick Rude, and he was being interviewed by Jesse Ventura, and it was a nuts and bolts exercise in how to get your guy over and how to do the job. Jesse says to him, "I'm a journalist, Bobby." Bobby replies, "I know that, Jesse. Well, I know the where, the what, and the who, but I don't know the why." And Bobby explains how to get the guy over, Rick Rude, who he's managing, against his opponent, with respect to his opponent, in his fun-making way. Bobby was just nuts and bolts, such a pure guy when it came to wrestling management. He was so good at it that, you know, he kind of left everybody else in the dust. And his greatest moment, in my personal opinion, was the rebirth of Ric Flair in the WWF. It really gave him a chance to shine and show everything he'd learned in that initial management run to get the Nature Boy over in this brand new environment in places where he'd never wrestled before, like Los Angeles and New York. If it wasn't for the Brain, Flair versus Hogan in that summer, in that late spring of 91, sorry, summer of 91, going up to the Royal Rumble in 1992, Flair would not have meant too much to the WWF fan base. Chelsea, you're a newer fan. You weren't around for his 80s glory run, but what are your thoughts on Bobby the Brain?
Well, I just finished Ric Flair and Charlotte Flair's new book last night, so I was reading the nice things that Rick said about him. And, I mean, it's the same as what everybody else says about him, is that he was exceptional as a manager because he was so easy to work with. He had such a great intuitive mind. And it also really sounds like everybody who worked with him says he was a lovely person, too, which is just really rare, frankly. not just in wrestling, but in anything. You know, it's a lot of times you get one or the other. You get somebody who's great at their job, or they're a really nice human being. And it's nice to hear about somebody who was both. And Ric Flair said in his book pretty much what you just said, James, that he credits Bobby with helping him tremendously when he was trying to get over with the WWE audience. And it's been really nice to read a bunch of the tributes that people wrote about him this week.
Yeah, I mean, the only reason why he came off the road with the Nature Boy was because Bobby couldn't keep up with Rick anymore. So they had to get Kurt Hennig because he's the only guy who could party 24/7 like Rick could. So yeah, it was very, very special period of time in wrestling. And Heenan was there for all of it. He was there for WrestleMania 3. He managed the biggest heel of all time in North American wrestling in the biggest show of all time with the biggest face of all time. It doesn't get any better than that as being a wrestling manager. And we'll say thank you to the Brain for everything. And on to All Japan Wrestling Grand Prix 1992. Now, as we are on this particular Sunday, we're recording the day before you hear it. Last night, Toni Storm took her title shot from winning the Stardom 5-Star Grand Prix and actually beat Mayu Iwatani for the Stardom World of Stardom Championship. Unfortunately, she was awarded the championship because Mayu dislocated her elbow after 2 minutes after missing a dropkick. Believe it or not, of all the dumbest of dumb things, Mayu's all right. Yeah, Mayu's okay. But, well, she will be okay in time. But, you know, tournaments like this have a long history. And in fact, the Stardom tournament that has happened over the last month or so, featuring people like Xia Brooks and Viper, Toni Storm, Mayu Iwatani, and all the regulars in Stardom Pro Wrestling, is still based on the same principle of this tournament. You have a red block and you have a blue block. And the winner of the red block goes against the second place in the blue block and so on and so forth till you get to a final. They did it 2 blocks, 2 semifinals and a final. And we're watching the final show of the card final card today. We're not going through the entire tournament because, you know, we did that a couple of weeks ago with the Championship Carnival tournament. But we're looking at the final card itself, which you can find on YouTube. It's out there if you want to look it up. It'll be AJW Grand Prix 1992, and it was on August 30th. And it's a pretty stacked card all the way through.
Yep.
It really is. There's no other way to describe it. We'll start from the beginning. The opening match. Now, every time we've looked at AJW, every opening match we've seen, or at least one of the matches we've seen, was Bat Yoshinaga versus Rei Tamada at some point. Now, this one's different in the fact it's not a mixed martial arts match, and it's a tag match. But Rei Tamada doesn't do any better than she normally does in a mixed martial arts match. She got red kicked in. She's tagging with Cynthia Marino, who clearly was wondering what she'd done to deserve being in the opening match with Rio Tamada. And they were facing like Bat Yoshinaga and Tomoko Watanabe, who were pretty brutal, really. It was an entertaining affair, but kind of meaningless fluff. What did you think, Chelsea?
I mean, it's an opening tag match, so like it's not meant to be anything super substantial. The thing that kind of, like a lot of AJW opening tag matches, the thing that kind of stands out is that everybody is rushing so quickly to try to get all their stuff in that it's just, you don't have a second to breathe and really appreciate it all. But, I mean, Tomoko Watanabe is really, really good. Cynthia Marino is really, really good. Rei Tamada is trying. I liked Bat Yoshinaga more in this match than I do when she's supposed to be a professional boxer.
Yeah.
But there's still something missing there. I don't know.
She was incredibly popular, you know. And out of these four, Tomoko Watanabe, I think, is the only one still active. She wrestles for Marvelous.
Jeez.
Yeah, she's still going.
She's probably in her 50s now, right?
48, I think.
So close to it.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, and showing no signs that she wears boots now. She isn't barefoot and swimsuit and gi. She's a bit more traditional wrestling attire these days. But yeah, it did what it said on the tin. Now, the next match was a corker. In fact, it was kind of a sleeper match. This was Debbie Malenko and Takeoka Inoue. They defeated Miura Kamiya and Keiru Ito, who is also still active for Marvelous, and she's 47, owner of the best moonsault in wrestling. Not in this particular time period. She was the owner of getting the best ass-kicking in wrestling from Debbie Malenko and Takeoka Inoue. Inoue and Malenko were absolutely stunning in this match. Takeoka Inoue is one of those people that was kind of overshadowed by the upper card in AJW. She did have successful tag runs. Debbie Malenko, again, she was kind of like the second phase of the Gaijins that came into All Japan Women, she was, I hate to say it, a Medusa Miceli clone, because she wasn't. She was much more of a white meat baby face, but she was in that kind of mold, but she didn't quite have the get-go to get there, as far as, like, in the same way Medusa Miceli did. And she didn't get involved in the main event play as much as the others, as Medusa Miceli did. Having said that, I love Debbie Malenko. She's so all business, and she's so such a good wrestler. Everything she does is crisp. Everything she does looks realistic. The same with Takako Inoue. Kamiara and Kaoru are very, very good as well. But you can see the gap in difference between these young girls who were just about to go off an excursion to CMLL and the next level up in Inoue and Malenko. What did you think of these guys, Chelsea?
Oh, man, this match is so good. It's really, really good. I totally agree with what you just said about Debbie Malenko and Takako Inoue being head and shoulders above their opponents. You can tell. Debbie Malenko is so awesome. Like, she, it's not just that her ring work is really crisp and that she has this really impressive arsenal of things she knows how to do really well. It's also that the transitions between moves make sense. They're really, really, I don't know if it's fluid is the right word, because a lot of it is like at this very staccato rhythm, but like she knows exactly how to get her opponent into the exact position she needs them to be in for whatever the next thing she's going to do is. And that's, if there's something that's missing in the inexperienced AJW girls on this card, not that there are very many of them, it's that. It's that a lot of them have these big splashy moves that look great because you can tell they've practiced them thousands of times.
Yeah.
But the stuff in between the big moves doesn't always land perfectly. And when you have people who are really seasoned, I mean, like, Debbie Malenko clearly knows what she's doing. I think at this point she'd been wrestling for, like, 6 years or something like that, so she's really, really good. And Takako Inoue is just, like, I mean, she's like clockwork. She's like a machine. She can just do it. It's really, really interesting watching the two of them play off each other, because they have that cool level of trust that really good tag teams have, you know, where you can tell they've worked together before and they know what's going on. So,
having said that, did you watch the promo at the end?
I did, but, oh, you mean the tension between the two of them?
Where they're just, like, he says, how'd you go? I said, well, better than I expected.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, well, you know, so, but yeah, carry on.
Well, I don't know. To me, the vibe that I got is that they're friends, right?
Yeah,
like, they've worked together in the dojo before. They probably, like, you know, even if they don't totally speak each other's languages fluently, they've probably talked to each other enough that they trust each other. So, I don't know. I really enjoyed watching the two of them as a team. And every time I watch Debbie Malenko in anything, I'm really devastated that her career ended. It was just about a year after this, right? 1993, she had to retire because she hurt her leg.
Yeah, yeah. It does really suck. I mean, arguably, at the time, where else would she have to go? She'd have to stay in All Japan to get that kind of level of pay and respect and creativity. She couldn't do that anywhere else. There wasn't anywhere else to do that at the time.
Right.
I mean, well, yeah, there was JWP and there was LLPW and FMW was coming along, but genuinely, like, there was only so many spots and she had one of the spots. And, you know, there wasn't anything in North America or even, I mean, there was All Star in the UK, but that's two markets you can work in. And even then, there's no guarantee you would have made money in the UK, and you got to get to the UK and pay taxes and so, yeah, it was sad and it's a shame, but having said that, she has such a good, strong body of work in the period she was active.
I mean, that's true. I guess I just feel sad looking at it because, like, I look at her work and think, wow, you know, she could be somebody who is where Medusa is now,
you know,
in that, like, emeritus position of, like, you know, elder stateswoman of wrestling. Like, I could see that in the future for her watching this. And then I remember it. I was like, oh,
that
she got
sucks.
Hurt. She had to retire.
Yeah. It is good. But on a positive note, Kuro Ito is still active, like I said, in Marvelous. She's the ace of Marvelous, and she works in Sendai Girls. She's tags with Dash Chisako. brilliant, brilliant hardcore tag team, does swing a mean table and chair and whatever else she brings with
Excellent.
Her.
Excellent.
Takoko Inoue is still active as well in many arenas. She spent a lot of time in CMLL after her AJW run, and she came back as a cattle prod weed wielding heel, and has also been in some DVDs that we won't mention for their BDSM content.
Oh.
that's her hobby. She that's what she likes doing.
Hey, why not?
Indeed. We are sex positive at this podcast, indeed. next, we go on to a final round match because Mariko Yoshida and Kikoka Inoue were both tied on points in the blue zone, so they had to have a playoff match. And this was where the crowd lit up. Now, I haven't seen an awful lot of Mariko Yoshida, but she was brilliant against Kikoka Inoue. And it was one of those match of nights of your lives performances. She was way better than I've seen her in anything else she's done before. And she just absolutely hit on all cylinders, and the crowd got behind her, which is really unusual because at this point, Kikoka Inoue was over like Rover with the All Japan Women crowd. I've never been a big fan of hers because I think there were better wrestlers, but I never denied her ability to get over and her ability to connect with an audience was paramount. And that's how she got by, rather than going by on wrestling skill or toughness like some of the other wrestlers. So this match was such a stark contrast, and the crowd rallied towards the end. They were screaming the house down. We're at Currican Hall, by the way, and this is one of those cards that makes Currican Hall such an important place for wrestling to be. Chelsea, what did you think of this match?
Oh my God, this is so good. Mariko Yoshida is, I totally agree, you never see her wrestle this well in anything I've watched of hers before this. I rarely hear people talk about her, except people who are like hardcore Joshi enthusiasts.
Yeah.
So this was awesome. Like, this was a really, really cool match. She just comes alive in this match. It's neat seeing her work with Kikoka Inoue, because Kikoka Inoue, I think of as someone who figures out creative ways to use other people's offensive maneuvers.
That's a very good way of putting it, yeah.
Like, she has kind of like her own toolkit that doesn't change very much from match to match, but she can figure out how to make the stuff that her opponent does look cool. And in this match, like, they just meet each other on the same level and just go for it. There's some really cool spots in this match. There's a couple of like springboard spots off the top rope that are really, really nuts. And there's a sunset flip powerbomb attempt at one point that goes, it doesn't go awry, but like it gets thwarted and countered, and it ends up in something really brutal. It's a really cool match, and the crowd is so hot for it. And what's really interesting is that when the match starts, the crowd is clearly more enthusiastic about Kikoka Inoue, which, I mean, she was always really over, like you said.
Yeah.
And by the time the match finishes, they're cheering for Mariko Yoshida. And I mean, I love seeing matches where that happens, especially when it's women's wrestling. I love that when both performers get over to the point where, you know, obviously it matters who wins, but it almost doesn't matter who wins because both of them did, because they both delivered. You know, that's really, really exciting. If you're going to pick a match to watch off this card, it's hard to pick just one. You really should watch the whole thing, but this is definitely one to check out because it's really, really cool.
It is indeed. Now, as far as the character of All Japan Women's concerned, if you wanted one match to sum up AJW in all its glory, I'd pick this match. This match pitted Bull Nakano, Yumiki Hotta, and Suzuki Minami against Akira Hokuto, Etsuko Mita, and Mimi Mishimoda, Los Cacajares Orientales, the Oriental Bitches. Now, this is a complicated play, but I'll explain it because it's worth explaining, okay? Los Cacajares Orientales formed about 3 years into Akira Hokuto's return to pro wrestling after breaking her neck. The person she was tagging with was Yumiko Hotta. The person that she tagged with when she came back was Suzuki Minami. The people she turned her back on to form Los Cacajares Orientales were Suzuki Minami and Yumiki Hotta. She formed it with Etsuko Mita and Mima Shimoda. This became a powerful trio until Akira Akuto left the company, and then Shimoda and Mita kind of made tag wrestling in their own image for a few years. But at this time, this was a heated feud because Minami and Hotta wanted their own back on Akuto storyline-wise, leaving them behind. And the one person they went to bring in help was Bull Nakano, because her and Akira Hokuto had such a big feud over the WWWA Women's Championship in the previous years, which ended in a brutal, brutal cage match. This match put all of these six people together. But halfway through the match, the camera pans down to the front row, and who is sat there but Kanbat Toyota and Megumi Kudo from FMW. And this was setting up their match against Bull Nakano and Akira Hokuto that me and Sai looked at on the FMW third anniversary show a couple of weeks ago. We're kind of out of sync here because I forgot this was on this card. So this sums up the entire history of Joshi in 1992 in one match, because one of the biggest matches in that time period were Bull Nakano and Akira Hokuto, as well as the FMW-AJW feud, certainly in 1992. And then there's a wrestling match. Well, it starts out as a wrestling match, and then it's a fight for a while, and then it's a wrestling match. And there's interference, and people jump in, and people don't care. At one point, Yumiki Hotta just walks in on Akira Hokuto, who's got a scorpion deathlock on Suzuki Minami, and just starts kicking as hard as she can in the face. And Hokuto doesn't move anywhere. She just sits there. It's insanely good and just insane for what it does in a space of 20 minutes. And then at the end of the match, by the way, Nakano, Hotta, and Minami win. Not that that really matters. At the end of the match, Kanbat Toyoda and Megumi Kudo stand up, look at the ring, nod, and walk away. Hanokato and Bull Nakano have spent the last 20 minutes kicking the living shit out of one another, turn to each other, nod, and leave the ring. Because that's our deal. That's our business sorted. Now we have to team up to go face these two. It's insane. It's beautiful. It's glorious. It's some of the best booking you will ever, ever see in wrestling anywhere, because it just, like, you've got these two sworn enemies, but we've got something to deal with. We have to bury the hatchet and get on with it. Chelsea, what do you think of this?
This is nuts. It's so good. It's like, it's hard to watch in places because they really do beat the crap out of each other, but it's so good. I love Bull Nakano. I mark for pretty much everything she does. She's so scary and vicious and great, which is hilarious because I think of her, of who she really is in real life, and she seems like she's very sweet. Like,
yeah, golf playing bar owner.
Yeah, in the ring, she wasn't sweet. She was just vicious, and it's wonderful. Yumiko Hotta is so over. Like, every time she gets in the ring in this match, the crowd volume doubles, and it seems appropriate. I mean, she can tag herself in, throw a kick, and then tag herself back out, and it just doesn't even, or not tag herself back up, but get tagged out, and it just doesn't even, you know, like, she lends excitement to the match just by being there in short spurts. Suzuki Minami is awesome. Like, she really goes for it in this match. I was very impressed with her. Akira Hokuto is just terrifying and wonderful and fearsome. And I recently read that apparently in real life, Akira Hokuto's husband proposed to her on their first date. And
yep.
I read that and I was like, yep, that sounds about right.
Do you know when that was?
No.
It was at the International Wrestling Peace Festival in North Korea, of all places, was the first time they met.
Wow.
And so actually, they have Eric Bischoff and Antonio Inoki to thank for their marriage.
Wow.
Because Kensuke Sasaki was IWGP, he was IWGP Tag Team Champion at the time with Hirohase. And Hokuto, it was Hokuto's second marriage, actually. She'd been married once before, which was unusual because she had that much sway with the AJW office. She could get married and not retire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
And then she divorced him, loser, went to Mexico for a bit, came back, and then she was tagging with Aja Kong against Asari and Minami Toyota, if I'm correct. No, it wasn't. It was Mariko Yoshida and Minami Toyota in a match that stole the show, obviously.
Yeah. Makes sense.
And Kensuke Sasaki, as honor of his wife, took the Northern Lights Bomb as his finisher.
And didn't they pass the Northern Lights Bomb on to Nakajima, who's one of his proteges?
Yep, they did. Yeah. He's their adopted son.
I like Nakajima more now because I know that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, this match is nuts. Gosh, what else is worth mentioning in this match? Like, I don't even want to describe this match because, like, I feel like people should watch it. Like, I can't possibly do it justice by talking to you about all the crazy shit that happens in this match. You should just watch it. It's awesome.
The thing you should really look for is the teamwork between Mita and Shimoda. You can tell they're going to be good. Just the rule breaking that they all come up with, the creative level of rule breaking that they all come up with.
Choking people with the rope? Yeah, that's legal.
Yeah, they can do all sorts of things. They didn't care. That was what made them great as a heel tag team. They didn't give a fuck. That was it. You know, I've mentioned this before because, like, Mima Shimoda used to every match, and when the LCO were really singing in the late 90s, every match Mima Shimoda power drove somebody through a table. That was happening. The first thing they were going to do, you know, set the tone. just something else. They were just, and these six together at full bore, just brilliant, brilliant wrestling.
Yeah, it's really good.
Then we have back to the Japanese Grand Prix. And the first semifinal was Aja Kong, who defeated Toshio Yamada. Now, Aja was just getting into her full-on Aja mode. She was the Aja Kong we know and fear today. And Toshio Yamada was in the middle of her tag team run with Minami Toyota. They just had that breathlessly good hair versus hair match for the IWA World Championship about a couple of weeks before, because Yamada still has a crew cut thanks to Toyota defeating her in that match. And then this match starts, and this was brutal. If you don't like blading, don't watch this match. I will give you that warning for a start. there's a safety warning for you there. But Yamada and Kong took it all over the arena and beat the crap out of one another. I think they kind of were under pressure after the previous match to get something special out of it, but it's a different kind of brawling. It's much more intense, and you can tell the stakes are really high in this match. And certainly Yamada sold for Kong brilliantly and put her over as such a big, strong threat for the rest of the tournament. Chelsea, what's your thoughts?
Part of what I love about this match is comparing it to the final and the stuff that Aja Kong does in the final, because it really shows her versatility as a performer.
Yeah.
I think that especially with big girl wrestlers, a lot of times people don't give them credit for the innovative stuff that they do that's unique to them. And Aja Kong, like, people always talk about how big and scary she is, and it's true. That is the overwhelming feeling that you get when you watch her wrestle. But she's not just big and scary. She's also a really good wrestler. Like, she has cool ways of making wrestling moves work for her and work for her body type that are really fun and interesting to watch. And she can work with so many different styles. Like, it's really interesting to watch her wrestle Yamada and then watch her wrestle in the final later, because it's not, you would think that the match itself would have to revolve completely around her skill set because she's the Goliath, right?
Yeah.
But it doesn't. Like, she can adjust what she does to suit the particular opponent that she has. And to me, like, that's one of the hallmarks of a really great wrestler, somebody who's like next level good, is that they can deliver matches even close together, in this case, even on the same frickin' card, that are completely different in terms of how they feel to you, because the person they're working with is different and they bring a different energy to it. So for me, that was the cool thing about this match, was watching it and then watching the final and comparing the two in my head and going, wow, those are totally different matches. That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, Aja gets doesn't get the respect she deserves, because like, she wasn't necessarily the draw that Bull Nakano was. She wasn't necessarily the monster that Dump Matsumoto was. But she's had a 30-year career, and she can wrestle anybody of any size and make it look interesting. She can beat the shit out of a rookie and make you care about it.
Yeah.
You know, and the match doesn't have to be 2 minutes long. I've seen her carry people who are utterly inept for 5 to 6 minutes and make them look like superstars. She beat them, yeah. But she, you know, she has a way. Her wrestling IQ is so good. What she needs to do to get the right thing over at the right time with the right person, she's so good at that, you know. And she's got such a stunning series of moves. She get the vertical brainbuster or the spinning back fist. There's so many ways she can beat you, you know. And that's
or she can just stand on you.
Oh, she can just stand on you, as we find out later in the card. She can be, you know, a great shoot style worker and do all the mat stuff you want. She can hurl you around with suplexes, and she can climb to the top rope too and feel and look like she's at home there, you know. And as a kick-based wrestler, she's so influential. Her and Yamada and Dynamite Kansai are so influential on what we see in kick-based wrestling these days. Guys like Nakajima that we talked about, guys like Daniel Bryan, you know, these people that have adopted their martial arts kicks into their wrestling style. These people were the first ones to do it really, really well in an acceptable way that didn't look like purely like shoot wrestling. You know, they were influenced by people like Fujiwara and Suzuki and Akira Maeda from UWF, but it wasn't a pure shoot style. They took that, they adapted it into pro style to make it interesting, and they were the first ones to do it really, really well. The people you really remember how they did it really, really well, and their influence is palpable in the modern wrestling game. They were wearing kick pads, you know, long before anybody else was as well. All right, the UWF guys did it first, but these were the ones that popularized it in mainstream pro wrestling. You know,
that's really cool.
It is. It really is. Then we move on to the semi-final with Minami Toyota versus Mikiro Yoshida. Sorry, Mariko Yoshida. I'll get that name right again. The second semi-final, Minami Toyota defeats Mariko Yoshida in a pretty classy match, and Yoshida continues the streak of great work on this one at this night. It was clear she had this bigger obstacle than Inoue, and there was probably feelings amongst the fans that could she make it? And in the end, Toyota gives her an incredibly good match, but Yoshida doesn't make it. But the fans absolutely love it up, and they gave her a standing ovation at the end of the match.
Yeah.
What did you think of this, Chelsea?
This is really good. It's really, really good. Mariko Yoshida is on fire this whole time, and it's cool watching her work with Minami Toyota, because Minami brings some really cool creative offense, which is the thing we all love about her, to the table, and makes her look really good. And they have chemistry. It's not like explosive, off the charts, set your hair on fire chemistry, but they get each other. And that is what's really important, you know? Like, it's cool watching somebody who I think of as like legendary, like Minami Toyota, help somebody else get themselves over, or, you know, like not just totally like squash them, even if they beat them. There's a real art to that, I think, if you can beat somebody and get them over, because so often in wrestling, I feel like it doesn't happen. You know, if somebody loses, everybody just kind of forgets about them immediately. And, this, like, the crowd is really, really hot for this. There's a lot of really cool moments in it. It's fun to watch. You can watch it and feel a little sorry for Yoshida when she loses, but also feel really proud of her because she just nails it.
Yeah, I mean, we looked at the 1990 Grand Prix with Alex Watt-Core about 2 or 3 months ago. And the Toyota in this match has grown so much in those 2 years, I think. She's lost the gangliness. She's still graceful and lithe, but she's looking more in control. She's looking like God's own wrestler that she would become. She's looking like everything she's doing is controlled. Everything she's doing is smooth. I even noticed, like, when she takes a back bump and she's laying out on the mat, her hair falls perfectly behind her, creating this black halo around her head. You know, there's so much to her that is becoming so much more perfect in presentation. Her moonsault is so crisp and looks so good. This was more in the final, but I'll get to that in a minute. But, you know, the springboards are starting to, she's getting more height and she's getting more accuracy and she's putting herself in the ring exactly where she wants to be at any time. And that takes talent and it takes work, and the amount of work she put in to get to that point must have been ridiculous. But you're right, that means that because she has such good ring generalship, such good placement, she can get Yoshida over by just how she sells, where she is in the ring. You know, that difference between being in the middle of the ring where she can't get out of things easily makes it so much harder for her. She understands that, and that tells the story so much better.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, it's a thing of beauty to watch. It really, really is, you know. And some of Toyota's best matches are with wrestlers that aren't as good as she is. When she was WWWA champion, she had a challenge from Kyoko Inoue. And we talked earlier about how Inoue uses other wrestlers' offense to get herself and her opponent over. And Toyota took advantage of that. They went for an hour in a match that, you could not had a dead spot. An hour they wrestled with no dead spots, which, you know, all right, you can, people can say, well, Flair used to do that every night, but you know, at the pace AJW women were going in 1994, Flair couldn't have done that. So, you know, it's something to see Toyota trying to get somebody else over and doing it with such aplomb. But it is all based in that talent base she has, that suppleness she has in her body. She is so bendable without being broken. And she has got such a good face for selling. You know, she can you feel everyone's emotion.
Yeah, her selling is incredible.
Yeah, you know, all the stuff she does on offense means absolutely nothing unless she's been put in peril. And because she is so good at selling, because she can show pain so easily, because she knows exactly when to turn that on and when to turn it off and when to toughen up and when to be the dark mistress that she needs to be, she is so good to watch. And in a match like this where she knows she's not going to be the face, Yoshida's had such a good run, she can afford to be, you know, not quite as face-orientated. It means so much to her that she can be more free of what she's doing, and that's what makes it a great match.
Yeah.
And then we get to the final, which pitted Aja Kong, as you'd probably guess, against Minami Toyota for the Japanese Grand Prix 1992 Championship in an absolute barnstormer. I don't think it's my favorite match on the card, but I cannot deny that this is a brilliant, brilliant match. And it sets up a 3-year story arc because Toyota tries and tries and tries again to beat Kong, but she doesn't manage it for 3 years. Now, you try telling a story like that in modern-day wrestling and see how far you get. This was brilliant. It was so well put together. It sets up the story of Kong versus Toyota, which will be the driving force behind the company for half a decade. It was brilliantly well done. It was brilliantly well told. And the participants in the match aren't quite yet at the peak of their power. You see something this good, and you see why the company was so dominant for so long. Chelsea, what do you think of this?
Oh, this is so good. I couldn't even finish watching it without like sending you direct messages on Twitter to like scream about it, because I mean, like, is there a pair in wrestling that personifies wrestling chemistry more than these two? I mean, come on. Like, it's so good every time they work together, and every match I've ever seen them have is different, and there are so many moments in this where, like, Aja is just like this amazingly brutal killer, and it's so good. And then when Minami finally gets her comeuppance and comes back at her with, you know, like Aja just like pile drives her into the ground and sits on her and stands on her chest in just the right way where you're like a little scared that she can't breathe, but you know she can breathe. And then Minami gets this series of like push off drop kicks where she comes off the top rope at her, and it's so good. They bring out the best in each other. They do the coolest, craziest shit when they work together, and it's awesome. I'm a big fan of when Aja got up on the top rope and Minami, I don't even know what this move is called. I was like, how have I not seen that more often, where Minami gets underneath her, hooks Aja's legs with her legs, and just kind of pulls her down off the rope. Like, nuh-uh, you're not going anywhere.
It has a special name, and I can't remember the name.
Right? Like, you don't see it that often because it's really dangerous to do because it's really easy for somebody to get hurt. And, you know, I mean, like, they work together without any signs of strain or effort. It's just like, okay, we're going to do this today, another day at the office, but it's electric and it's awesome. It's so good. And I felt really bad for my mommy when she lost. I was like, oh no, she took all that punishment for nothing. But I know she gets her comeuppance like later, but it's still like, I was a little sad for her. And seeing Aja get to have the big moment at the end with her hand raised was nice. It's a really good match. It's not the best match those two have ever had, because I mean, like, the bar is set so high there, but it is really, really good. It's a lot of fun.
It's called the Victory Star Drop.
Okay. Yeah.
Avalanche body scissors backflip into a back-to-back kneeling pile driver, which she invented.
Is that the one that's in this match? I thought the Victory Star Drop was in a different match.
Yeah, that's the one in the... That's the one in the Tokyo Dome match.
I feel like the one in this match is maybe like the start of like the idea that becomes the Victory Star Drop. I don't think it's the full-on Victory Star Drop, because don't they only ever do that once?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Because
yeah.
It's really dangerous.
It is ridiculously dangerous.
But it's really, really cool. Like, they clearly know how to push each other's buttons. Like, they get natural competitiveness out of each other, which is cool to watch. Like, you can tell, I think, a little bit if you've watched them wrestle a bunch when they're competing with each other, where they're playing the character, right? And they're selling. And you can tell when they're having moments of like, bitch, how dare you? I'm going to come after you for what you just did. And it's so much fun. It's just, they have a blast doing it, even though they're like killing themselves and killing each other. And that's always a lot of fun to watch.
It is. I'm just looking at, I searched Minami Toyota on DuckDuckGo as I was just trying to find that information. And you realize that her AJW graduation match was with Aja Kong. The final of this tournament, she won the championship in 1990, but by this point, the field was a lot stronger in 92 than it was in 1990, because you had Aja Kong, who was no longer All Pacific champion, so she was in the field. You had, it was round robin, so the profile of the tournament was a lot higher. So this was probably the biggest match she'd had in her career, apart from the IWA Heavyweight Championship with Yamada. You know, she's coming off all this momentum, and You're right. It's just like that other day, another day at the office kind of feel to this match. You know, got to wrestle Aja again. What am I going to do this time? You know, and
yeah,
you know, it takes them. Like I said, they got real good at this over the space of 4 or 5 years. The match they have together at the Tokyo Dome, which I'm sure we will look at when we get to 1995, because it was probably that card was the biggest women's wrestling card of all time, and we'd be churlish not to look at that particular card. That match was absolutely phenomenal. And then that wasn't the one where she won the championship. There was another match in 95 after that, which was also phenomenal. You know, it takes her, these two are tied, married together on and off for 4 or 5 years. And, you know, at one point there is, not long after this, there's a tag match where Toyota tags with Kong against Yamada and Bull Nakano. Because why not?
You know. I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that so many of the best women's wrestler in the world. I mean, you get this with men too, but so many of the best women wrestlers in the world are great competitors who beat the crap out of each other, and then they're also friends and they can also work together. And I say this all the time, like, there just aren't that many media that tell stories with female characters in it where the characters themselves get to have that much depth, you know?
No.
Like, the fact that they have these real life relationships where they have a connection with one another, whether or not they're best friends, you know, the fact that that strengthens the fiction is just really, really awesome and gives it so much character and depth. It's awesome.
I mean, there's. I was listening to an interview with Mike Quackenbush when Manami Toyota came to the UK for Pro Wrestling Eve last year. Mm-hmm. Quack was on the which podcast was it? It was the New Generation podcast, of which he's a big fan. He was on that, and he explained one of the greatest things he did in his career was bringing Manami Toyota and Aja Kong to Shikara for
Joshi Mania.
Now, and he did say that he didn't believe that Manami and Aja were getting along too well at the time, but they both work for Oz Academy, so to survive in the same dressing room when you don't get along shows how professional the pair of them are. But they did get in the ring together for Joshi Mania, and they wrestled each other. And Mike Quack said it was one of the proudest moments of his career that he managed to get those two together in the ring at the same time to relive, even if it was just 30 seconds of that magic that those two had. It was, and she's right. It'd be interesting to see who Manami Toyota invites to her retirement show in November, because I don't think...
I just asked that on Twitter. Yeah, I'm wondering, like, who is she going to pick for her last opponent?
Because if we were going to pick anyone who's still active from that era, it would have to be Aja, wouldn't it? If you really want... If we're talking dream matches, you'd want to see Toyota versus Kong one more time. You know, because people don't talk about that feud in the same way we currently talk about Omega versus Okada, or even Flair versus Steamboat, but we should.
Yeah.
You know, it was just something that drove a company forward, and there were so many distractions going on around them as well. I mean, there was the AJW FMW feud, the LLPW feud, there was the JWP feud, there was all this interpromotional work that was going on at the same time, but those are the two wrestlers picked to carry the company during its biggest period of growth. And it was Austin and The Rock. Except the characters were more in depth. They connected with people in completely different ways. And they were better wrestlers.
And the wrestling's a lot better. Like, a lot better.
Yeah. I mean, I love Steve Austin as a wrestler. As an in-ring character, he's awesome. But at that point in his career, in the Attitude Era, he'll be the first to admit he was not the wrestler he was 5 years before, because he physically could not do it. And The Rock was never a great wrestler. He had great timing, which is a talent all in itself, and he knew exactly what to do at the right place at the right time. But again, in North American wrestling, you don't have to be a great wrestler to get over, and those two proved it. Austin was a better wrestler in 91 in WCW than he ever was in the WWE. But he couldn't do it anymore, and he got the most out of what he couldn't do, and that's an absolute talent, and more power to him from being able to do it. He was brilliant, but I'd rather watch these two wrestle any day of the week.
Yeah, even now where they're not going to do the stuff that they did when they were like 19 and, you know, 20 years old, but it doesn't matter. Like, if they had that match, I'd watch it.
Yeah, because they know exactly how to get those emotions out of a crowd with less. I mean, you look at Manami, she's a lot heavier now than she was in her heyday, and I would assume a lot of that is to do with the fact that, well, age is one thing, but another thing is she can take bumps a lot better the size she is than she could back then, because she was absolutely rail thin, and she took some hellish beatings from Kong and Nakano and all these women who were 100 pounds heavier than her, but she managed to have this 30-year career. You know, and a lot of that came down to conditioning and training and how hard work, how flexible she was in this particular time period. She still sells perfectly well now. She still's a brilliant seller now. But back then, she was the best at selling of anyone I've ever seen. You know,
I really wouldn't be surprised if now she has some chronic pain issues, to be honest. It's suspected that maybe one of the reasons why she's retiring, because... Yeah. I mean, how could you do the stuff that she did to her body and not have some lasting after effects?
You know, her bump card. The fact that her bump card hasn't filled up before now is a miracle in itself. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
You just can't do those kind of things to your body, and she did it longer than most people did. You know, and did it to a much higher standard than anyone ever has done before. But equally, how many moonsaults a night, how many landing on the knees, how many drop kicks to the floor. You know, there's only two people who did powerlift drop kicks off the top rope to the floor. One was the Dynamite Kid and one was Manami Toyota, and Dynamite's in a wheelchair. You know, so she did all of those things, and Aja too. You know, she's showing no signs of slowing down. Her style wasn't as impactful as far as her body was concerned, but she managed to parlay that into a 30-year career, and she's been at it longer than Manami has.
Wow.
You know, it's these two are just incredible, and you need to watch this wrestling match. You need to watch all of their wrestling matches. Not in their, well, yeah, all of theirs in their careers. As many as you can find. But this series of matches between Kong and Toyota is Flair Steamboat, is Okada Omega, is Steve Austin The Rock. It's all of those things with better wrestling, longer matches, more risks, and big, big crowds.
Sorry, I'm like I don't have anything to add after that, man. I think we covered it all.
We did. So let's just round up AJW in 1992 and 1992 in wrestling in general. We've still got a few minutes left, so we can have a talk at this. Now we try and do these episodes 1 year in five parts, and we pick the best cards we can in those five slots that we have. And we've been to AJW twice. We've done New Japan Pro Wrestling. Where do you think, first of all, AJW is in 1992? Back in 1990, you were saying that it was where the kernel of an idea of things were going to happen. Now you've got all these main event players who are coming into fruition. They're really blossoming as main event wrestlers. Where do you think AJW is in the wrestling business?
Oh, man. It's kind of hard to gauge. Well, I mean, I tweeted earlier that watching it is kind of like reading the book before they make the HBO drama, because you get to see wrestling like 10 to 20 years ahead of its time.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's hard for me to gauge because of my inexperience with other stuff that was happening in that time period elsewhere. If that was the sense that other people had about it at the time. I mean, it's very clear to me watching this compared to basically anything else that was happening in 1992, that it was very advanced and, you know, really puts a lot of what was going on in North American wrestling to shame. My God.
Yeah.
It's so ahead of its time that I'm not sure. I don't know that I get the sense that it was properly appreciated while it was happening.
I think you listen to the crowds at Currican Hall, and we were looking at the All Japan Wrestling crowd shows the other week with Sai, and the crowd response is different, but similar. Obviously, they're wrestling fans cheering for wrestlers, but the response seems more full-blooded and more full-throated. The actual reactions to wrestlers seem to grow differently with the wrestlers. It depends. There was very few people in that AJW tournament brought the level of intensity that Kong and Toyota do. Certainly, you know, Kawada did, Misawa did, Kobashi and Hanson. But, you know, I think those two companies were on a par with each other. New Japan wasn't quite there yet as far as in-ring content was concerned. It had every chess piece in place to be the biggest company in Japan, and they were working on a very different model to what All Japan were doing, women and men.
Right.
You know, New Japan were after a mass market. They were like the WWE of Japanese wrestling. They were trying to appeal to everyone, whereas All Japan Pro Wrestling was kind of much more about appealing to a very narrow market that had lots of money. So it was a different kind of model, and All Japan Women is kind of somewhere in between. It was populist, but equally it was a very niche market as well, because women's wrestling was kind of niche. So there's a lot of balance point between where AJW is. They're not as big as New Japan. They're not earning as much money as All Japan, but they're certainly doing something that's artistically very rewarding and also making a lot of money as well.
It kind of drives me a little crazy sometimes when we talk about the pay disparity between the guys in New Japan Pro and like Joshi wrestlers now.
Yeah.
Like the things that these women are willing to do for what I think of as being kind of like a meager paycheck proportionate to what they're doing. I mean, like, I don't know if this is true, but I read that WWE signed Kairi Hojo for her base pay is like 60,000 a year?
Yeah, around about that. That's the rumor anyway.
That's nuts.
Yeah,
that's nuts. She's one of the best in the world. Like, she's better than 90% of the dudes they have on their main roster.
And she didn't go to the WWE for money. She took a pay cut to go to NXT.
Yeah, you know, she was making more in Stardom, especially with all the merch sales that she was doing in Stardom. She doesn't have any merch yet in NXT.
No, you know, she'd be on 100 grand a year, probably, as the second biggest draw in Stardom. Shirai would probably be on 150 grand. I would think the guys in Oz Academy probably earn more, but none of the top stars are going to be earning more than $200,000.
Whereas, like, if you think about, like, you said Io Shirai is probably, like, 150 grand a year. Okada gets paid, like, what is it, 2 million a year?
Yeah. Dave Meltzer was talking about this because he did get offered WWE contracts about three or four years ago after his first run as IWGP Heavyweight Champion. Mm-hmm. And WWE rumored to have offered him $1 million start money as base pay. To which Dave said, if they'd gone for 3 million... they'd have got him, but he ain't leaving.
Why would he?
There's
no good reason for him to do that.
No, he's not going to go anywhere until he's seen someone else do it first. And the way that Nakamura is going at the moment, he ain't leaving. He would rather stay there, make the company as big as it possibly can be in Japan, and make it as big as it possibly can be in North America, and help that along, because he'll get paid more money anyway, without being buried and having to start all over again for the second, third time in WWE. So, yeah. But equally, you know, Okada on $2 million, he's a guy who can have... And it's a very noble thing, don't get me wrong. Every time he wins a match with a Rainmaker, he puts $10,000 into the Rainmaker Foundation, which looks after cancer charities. But anyone who can win that many matches with a Rainmaker and afford to drop 10 grand every time is earning an awful lot of money.
Yep.
You know, and I'm not knocking him for that. Good on you. Well done, Kazuchika. However, that does mean you're earning a lot of cash to do that in the first place. And
Io Shirai should be getting paid whatever AJ Styles is getting paid, because she's better than him anyway. I'm just saying it.
Yeah, she's easily better than anyone on the WWE roster, as far as I'm concerned. You know, Hojo probably. Asuka, but I prefer her to Asuka. No one else comes close. None of the guys do. So, you know, but that's just me. You know, that's my personal taste. And I understand my personal taste is not the average wrestling fan.
You have to say that so that people don't send you nasty messages on Twitter.
Yeah, but, well, I get enough nasty messages on Twitter. But it's just, well, yeah, you know, I like what I like, and you like what you like, but you all like what we like. And I understand that, you know, the main drawing audience for North American fans is men's wrestling. But boys are boring.
Us intellectuals thinking women are better at wrestling than men.
But they have to be. You know, I'm not breaking the door down to watch men's gymnastics, but I'll sit there all day and watch women's gymnastics because it's more interesting, because their bodies are made to do the job a lot better.
I also think the stakes are higher.
Yeah, they are. But equally, the women's bodies are designed much better for gymnastics than men's bodies are. Not to knock men's gymnastics. I think it's a noble art that more people should do. It's clearly very healthy for you, but it's just not something I'd want to watch as a spectator sport.
Mm.
You know, it's just women are better at certain things because of the way their body works. But, you know, you'd be a fool and a communist to think so.
I feel like you may have to cut this little bit at the end if you don't want to get lots of nasty messages on Twitter.
Don't care. Really don't care. I'm in a bit of a mood about things today, and if you want to fight, fine.
All right. Bring it on.
Not you.
No. I'm saying bring on the Twitter hate. Let's do it.
Okay then. Yeah, you can find us on Twitter at Sheriff Lone Star. That's me. And you can find Chelsea. Well, shall I give your Twitter handle?
It's fine.
Okay.
It's a private account.
Okay. You can find her at Chelsea Comics as herself, but she also tweets at Shoulders Up and offers some fine, fine wrestling commentary at the wonderful Shoulders Up organization, where you can find some podcasts and some writing as well. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Next week, we should be back with Destruction in Kobe. Until then, please listen to the other podcasts on the WrestleTalk PV podcast network, the YouTube channel as well, all that free content that we give you from week to week and day to day. We hope you enjoy your week, and take care, and we'll see you then. Bye!